This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
Welcome back to Threshold. On Threshold, we believe in individual and collective destiny. We believe in a purpose in life and the ability to be guided by a higher power. And in keeping with these peculiar notions, we are very particular about who we invite. Our guests need not share our views about our methodology of selection, but we believe they should realize that we think they are all very special. I suppose we were initially drawn to Sarah K. Westall, who I fortunately found on LinkedIn, by the fact she was a radio host at the Conscious Radio Network. And we were initially impressed by her focus on disruptive technology and game changers, as well as her seeming regard for individual rights and the freedoms who we as citizens of America and planet Earth were all meant to have. So given our interest in this sense of purpose, which we believe inhabits overtly or sometimes secretly tucked away underneath our human personalities in each individual, we are happy to invite Sarah to our program. Sarah, please explain to our audience how you came to be interested in developing a program called Business Game Changers on the network called Conscious Radio. We are also interested in telling our audience about how you discovered your mission, or perhaps one of your primary missions in life, something which gives us human beings a good reason to enjoy our life on this planet. Sarah, tell us all about yourself.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that awesome intro. I really appreciate it. But yeah, my show is Business Game Changers, and we're on the Conscious Business Radio Network. And I just absolutely love what I do. But I cover innovation, disruption, and big issues. I'm very interested in covering impactful inventions and society shifts or paradigm shifts. And I mostly take a business perspective. And that's because business tends to drive pretty much everything that happens. You know, hopefully the needs of the people drives business, but that's not always the case, as we are well aware.
Something called the need for profit.
Yeah, there is. Yes. And business tries to strive for the needs of the people, but it doesn't always work that way, as we know. But I really try to take a big picture look at what's going on. And it's critical in determining, you know, taking a big picture is critical in determining where the events and innovations and trends are taking us from a society point of view in the short and long term. And how I do this is I bring in leading experts in business and science and economics and government, not just celebrities, but also people who've been in the trenches, people who've led big companies or are leading innovation. I try to bring on people who I really believe have insight and have some real experience and great insight onto what's going on. People who are in the middle of the trenches, sometimes that's where you get the best information from. And, you know, I think that how that differs is that most of the media out there, and unfortunately, they focus on either trivial, issues or things that they just more fluff pieces, things that are more entertaining, or they tend to focus on just parts of the picture, and it tends to be more tunnel vision.
Well, I'm curious as to what motivated you to actually do this kind of thing, because, like you say, this is not typical. And yet, I believe it is critically important. This is what we need to understand if we're going to be play a part as citizens and consumers.
Well, how I started is I have an engineering degree and a business background. And I was initially, when I came out of college, I worked for US West Communications, which is one of the, the telecommunication baby. It wasn't a baby bell, but it kind of came out of that whole system. Right. And at that time, I moved up pretty quick in that company, and I was responsible for all the systems design for the networking part of US West. And that meant I designed the overall data perspective on the internet part of US West, which the enterprise, which was part of US West, was the we were launching the internet. And back in the early 90s, the internet was just up and coming. And I was responsible for all the system design for that organization. And it was kind of a heady time because US West had 75% of the internet backbone, which was Frame Relay at that time. Wow. So yeah, it was really interesting. And we had all the big companies wanting to partner with us. We had Netscape at the time, Microsoft, AT&T. We were also one of the only companies in the country that had a full Next computer, which was the predecessor to Apple, you know, what Apple is today, because they used all their hardware, or not their hardware, their software is the backbone of the Apple computer today, which was Steve Jobs' company when he left Apple.
Well, I saw the movie about Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I don't know if we were in there, but we had a complete...
Next was in the movie. That was a big part of the movie, actually.
Yeah, well, and Next, we were the telecommunication company that had a full-blown implementation of the Next computer across across our division, and that was the internet. And so we were a big deal at the time. I doubt that was in the movie because it was so business and technology-oriented that I doubt they would get into the details of that.
No, they didn't get into those details. It was just that he kind of used Next, his ideas, as leverage to... get back in the game again.
Oh, yes. And he did. And that was, it was Unix-based, right?
Yeah.
And Unix was developed at AT&T, and AT&T was a big deal at the time. And Unix is so much more powerful, so much better than any of the other operating systems out there. And that's what Apple's built on today. And all the server environments and such were based on that. But how I got into what I'm doing today is I was responsible for modeling the business from end to end. And so I ended up seeing this big picture look at business from all the way from pre-sales and analysis all the way to selling to implementing to operating a business. And so I ended up getting this big picture look at analyzing the internet business. And so I was in all these executive meetings and I was seeing this big picture look at something that was going to change the world coming onto the stage. And I was in charge of the system design at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I had just an amazing part at a very young age, part of this thing. And it really taught me a different perspective. That what I struggled with was the fact that marketing was so much more important than when the dot-com boom happened.
Right, sure. Marketing
was so much more important than reality. People were putting together just BS and they were getting funded. The people who were really putting together good things weren't being funded unless they had the BS to go back behind it. The really good creators were being taken advantage of by the financiers. It was just it was backwards. Everything to me seemed backwards. And so I just kind of got into my thing. I used my same strategy of understanding that whole system environment to understanding the world, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And used it as a paradigm.
Yeah, because it's a lot of the same. And I hear other leaders in different industries are using some of those same approaches to aging or for curing cancer or for doing different things. And I really think it is how you can solve problems and you can really connect dots. You look at patterns and relationships between all sorts of things. And that's what I did, except it was across the entire, network environment.
Very interesting. Well, in honor of your interest, we're going to look at various game changes in various industries, mostly involving disruptive technology, and assess how these changes have affected life in America and in the rest of the world. So we're going to use your paradigm in the biggest possible way. Let me just make a little statement about the word disruptive, and you tell me if I'm correct. As I understand it, disruptive refers to the effect of a new technology or a new way of doing things, how it might affect an industry, forcing changes that might affect profitability in an older sector in that industry as it yields to profitability in a new sector. In some cases, it could greatly decrease overall revenues in the entire industry, like conceivably what cars did to the horse and buggy business at the turn of the century, which at one point was a transportation business for people to get around. From the standpoint of the transportation sector of our economy, this was a tremendous move upwards. although it was a disaster for the buggy manufacturers, I'm sure. On the other hand, it was purely golden for the car business, the new kid on the back in the transportation sector. Now, I'm not talking about trains and steamships here. I'm really talking about people riding around with their families, say, getting things done, going places, even for business in a smaller way. On the other hand, I doubt if anyone could say in the long run it was so much of a plus for environment, the health of American citizens, or the vitality of the horse trade, or for the safety of the persons transported, compared to riding around in a horse-drawn vehicle. But of course, the value of the car to the public for business and pleasure is exponential. I've not seen much change of regressing to the horse and buggy domination of the transportation market. Well, I should say, unless some of the people in political power remain there, it might be possible. Of course, who knows what self-driven cars will do to the industry. Soon we will no longer know how to flush toilets or pull paper towels out of receptacles. Now for the next segment that we're going to do in a minute or two after a commercial break, I'd like you to paint a picture of technological disruption that occurred in the newspaper, say, since the early 60s, when offline newspapers were the foundation of that business. Will you be able to help us with that?
I sure can, or I'll try my best.
Well, we'll be back in a few minutes. This is Threshold Radio. Speaking of disruption, here's a song by Zave Nathan and Bonnie Blazak about positive disruption, something we desperately need. It's called Change.
That in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists.
Genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Peace for all men and women, peace in all time.
6 billion human beings. I'm one of them. I believe with every human being wants happy life, successful life.
This was one of many great songs by Zave and Bonnie. Listen to their music on SoundCloud, Zave Music. Now here's something about Boots in Manhattan, a novel I've written with U.S. Marine veteran and career crime fighter, Ray Boylan. Before we wrote this, I helped Ray edit his fantastically interesting memoir, West Side Warrior. Both books are available in Kindle.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who was a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was 6. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy, we ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hands. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070. This is Johnny Bluestar. We're back with Sarah K. Westall discussing disruptive technology. And particularly, Sarah has promised me that she will help us look at a particular industry. It's a good example, I think, to choose the newspaper business, which I think is rather interesting what's happened to it. But first, I'd like to play two short segments of speeches. The first is from President Kennedy in a speech delivered to the American Newspaper Publishers Association in the Waldorf Astoria in April 12, 1961.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, There is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
Although this was made 55 years ago, I believe that many people today who care about America would feel very safe with the sentiments Kennedy delivered at the time. Sarah, how do you feel about Kennedy's comments in this segment? Am I not correct in thinking that the newspaper business in 1961 had experienced many decades of reasonable continuity as far as technology was concerned?
Well, yeah, it was pretty consistent. They had the printing press for a long time, and the newspaper business was different than it is today, obviously. We don't have a huge newspaper sector like we did then, but it was also a lot more spread out, a lot more smaller, independent newspapers. So there was a lot more thought given to independent thought, and you could get more information on just daily events inside local communities. And also the funding was there to fund journalists overseas and to get good information. You know, everything is so business. The bottom line is so important now that we don't get that same. But going to what you're saying about Kennedy, I think that when you look at what was going, everything has to be done in context. During that time, the Cold War was going on, and it was just a different time. People were much more innocent. The masses were much more innocent. I think that people trusted their government much more. The words that Kennedy used in that speech would be taken different today, I think. Because, and I think you're going to have a clip that you're going to play of Obama.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Obama was much more direct at transparency in the clip. And, you know, Kennedy put a trust in the people to self-monitor, to don't publish things that's going to hurt the United States. Right. And he was asking for people to be responsible. Now, if a president today said that, there would be an outcry. I mean, I'm not sure if people would respond the same way. The 2020 vision, looking back at Kennedy, people look at him as a good president and they see him as what he was trying to do and they take him on his word. Today, I'm not sure if we take people on their word. We just don't trust anything that anyone says of our politicians. So we just don't view it the same way.
Well, I agree with that. Well, as someone who's been working in media most of my adult life, I think what has astounded me most was the arrival of the internet, which you had worked on in the beginning, and in so many ways has been such a blessing. And in my case, back in the 1990s, I believe it held the future of the newspaper business. So I developed an internet platform for a community newspaper in Coachella Valley called CV News, and I advertised for citizen reporters or volunteer reporters to assist me in its development. My idea at the time was to develop a platform that could be utilized in different areas throughout the world, sort of a voluntary global internet news platform. In other words, I was looking to put CNN, a volunteer type of CNN platform, on the internet. But I was very disappointed because there wasn't much of an audience for news and advertisers on the internet. Many people had already tried out advertising. It was nowhere near as big as it is now. And I was more or less forced out of business by an unreceptive market. Later, when the rise of Huffington News came, and with the idea of a citizen reporters, which was built into her paradigm, and then there were many other online newspapers virtually changing everything, I believe I was proven to be some kind of a prophet, very sadly, years ahead of his time. Looking at the 1990s, Sarah, what do you think was the point of view of consumers and industry in general towards the internet? How many individuals and businesses realize that you probably did that it would eventually obliterate many of our ideas and ways of doing business?
Well, people don't see changes before they come. People are getting better at it, and executives are getting better at it, but they just in general won't see it, especially if it's going to be a huge paradigm shift, which the internet really was. And I mean, it's just like the personal computer, right? Xerox didn't want to invest in it. HP didn't want to invest in it. There was huge companies that would not invest in the personal computer. And thus you have, you know, Gates' story, Microsoft's story, and you have Apple's story, and you look at their stories. It's a very common trend throughout all of history. People just don't know what the next big thing is going to be. They're trying hard now. And because there's been so many obvious bad experiences, that executives are trying hard not to be in that same pitfall. And we have a whole industry now of venture capitalists trying to, you know, find those next big things. But back in the day when the internet was taking off, you were a early starter, right? You're one of the first pioneers in it. And a lot of times the pioneers aren't the ones that end up cashing in. It's the fast follower, because the cost to get to that next level is you have to wait it out, and the cost to educate the consumer is long, hard, and expensive. So the timing coming into the industry is the most important thing.
I mean, I really envisioned this whole thing that happened.
Yeah, you were right.
I mean, I also, when I was doing The Adventures of Ganymede Jones, which was my first science fiction radio series, I saw a place for film franchises in the science fiction field. This was before Star Trek and Star Wars started it. And I actually envisioned it, and I tried to do it. But again, I was a little bit early.
Yeah, big timing is so important. It's hard. You know, the road is littered with people who came in at too early, and being a fast follower, and timing is something special, you know, and figuring that out. And there's a lot of luck to business. It's not all just being a genius. It's also about having luck. And it sounds like you have all the right stuff. It just, you needed a little luck.
Well, maybe with talking to people like you, I'm on my way.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. I hope so.
We're going to now get into a more serious side of this. And I'd like to play this interesting piece from which I'm calling, or which has been called, Obama's Promise of Transparency to America, that I think, at least in content, aligns with Kennedy's desire for openness in government.
But the way to make a government responsible is not simply to enlist the services of responsible men and women or to sign laws that ensure that they never stray. The way to make government responsible is to hold it accountable. And the way to make government accountable is to make it transparent so that the American people can know exactly what decisions are being made, how they're being made, and whether their interests are being well served. The directives I am giving my administration today on how to interpret the Freedom of Information Act will do just that. For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rules said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over. Starting today, every agency and department should know that this administration stands on the side not of those who seek to withhold information, but those who seek to make it known. To be sure, issues like personal privacy and national security must be treated with the care they demand. But the mere fact that you have the legal power to keep something secret does not mean you should always use it. The Freedom of Information Act is perhaps the most powerful instrument we have for making our government honest and transparent, and of holding it accountable. And I expect members of my administration not simply to live up to the letter, but also the spirit of this law. I will also hold myself as president to a new standard of openness. Going forward, anytime the American people want to know something that I or a former president wants to withhold, we will have to consult with the Attorney General and the White House counsel, whose business it is to ensure compliance with the rule of law. Information will not be withheld just because I say so. It will be withheld because a separate authority believes my request is well grounded in the Constitution. Let me say it as simply as I can. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency.
I'd like to underscore how Obama says transparency and the rule of law will govern his administration. I contend that Obama's transparency promise, which came after the Bush administration, was an indication, as were many of his campaign promises, of a return to constitutional practices and a revival of the hope of ridding our social system of non-ethically challenging use of internet technology, specifically affecting the news industry and the access of the public to meaningful news. How do you look at the transparency issue in light of things that happened after this little, so well articulated promise was made?
Well, I think it's pretty interesting what he said. It's almost crazy what he said. You don't really know what his agenda is. Is he trying to tell people that that's what it's going to be to try to get the, you know, the masses will believe almost anything they're told. And there's a certain effect that they really want to believe what they're being told. So he might be talking to them, or he might have intended at the time to be more transparent. I don't know, but obviously he hasn't been that transparent.
Sarah, what I say to that, you know, the people who have said to me, well, Obama, there was pressure on Obama when he became part of the presidency, which he was already, I believe, when he made that statement. I don't think that what has happened and continued to happen by the Bush administration could possibly not have been in the works before he became president, because he would have to think that way. The way he was thinking and the way he projects his thoughts in this particular segment is why he was elected. But it doesn't reflect anything that happened in his administration.
Well, it's... You know, it's really hard to watch someone speak so candidly about an open and honest government and then watch the behavior that is so not that, that is so opposite of that, and wonder what really is going on. And let me just give you, you know, some examples of some of the secretive nature of this government, which is, it's hard to watch that clip, really, when you see some of the secret things that they're doing, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Right.
And that's the big trade agreement that we do with so many countries. And it was so secretive. Congress had to go into a guarded room, could not take pictures. They couldn't take notes. They couldn't make copies. They couldn't divulge details. And it was such a secretive process. And that, to me, is just completely against what he was talking about there. The other thing is that is crazy is that, you know, the persecution of whistleblowers that we've had with this administration. We are currently considered the 49th in the world. According to Reporters Without Borders, they do a Freedom of the Press Index, and we are currently rated 49th in the world. Now, 49th isn't as bad as it sounds, because there's a huge gap between, you know, we're the lowest of kind of that upper group of countries, and then there's a huge drop, but it's still bad. And we have had more persecutions of whistleblowers under this administration than all other administrations combined under the Espionage Act. And it's just crazy that that speech could also coincide with this administration. So I don't know where he was at mentally. Obviously, he was coming off a campaign where the Bush administration was accused of so much confidentiality, and there was a lot of confidentiality. But, you know, there's a poll that Fox News, now it's Fox News, of course, and you have to take it for what it is, but they did do a poll, and they said that 37%, oh, this is a poll on whether they believe that, you know, whether Obama tells lies or not. And it said 37% said most of the time, 24% said some of the time, 20% said only now and then, and 15% said never. So 81% of Americans believe that Obama lies to them at least now and then on important matters. So that's pretty significant. You know, it's Fox News and you don't know, but I'm sure they did some kind of poll where it came out this way.
Well, yes, they wouldn't mind Obama being considered a liar by the public. But I think anybody who spends any time looking at his campaign, the campaign that he was proposing and what has actually been done, would have to go into almost the state of shock. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and we will explore some of the implications of what you've been talking about, Sarah. Now, here's some information and a taste of the powerful and inventive musical compositions of the Russian composer Edgar Arendt. Edgar, since a child, aspired to writing musical scores for film, but he also began a number of years ago to work with myself as lyricist and the amazing Patricia Welch as a performer on a variety of songs. But now, let's hear something from the purely musical side of his efforts. I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Arin for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I am very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
We're back on Threshold Radio with Sarah K. Westall. We're discussing disruptive technology, but right now we're trying to penetrate into the existence of the newspaper business as it does now, and the effect of the internet on it, and various aspects of this that might show a certain disrespect for constitutional rights that goes even beyond the Fourth Amendment and right into the heart, say, of the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Both freedom of speech and freedom of the press revolve to a large extent around traditional and online media to reach their audience, right?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the freedom of the press has changed quite a bit, or the press has changed quite a bit. With the advent of the internet, now we have, instead of a media of one to many, we have a many to many kind of situation going on. So we have people communicating with each other all over the place. Social media, social media has exploded. And so we have the advent of everyday people being journalists and putting information out there. And that has completely changed the way people are getting their information. Well, it's completely changed the way people have gotten information. The problem is people don't know what information is good and what isn't. And I just did a story on the Second Amendment, and it was amazing when I was looking for facts for both sides. And you can find, you know, something coming out of Harvard that says that, you know, keeping guns, you know, restricting the Second Amendment, you know, coming up with more restrictions has helped murders go down in this country. And then you can find the opposite side where it says that more guns makes people more safe, coming from another journal coming out of Harvard. right?
Yeah.
And so depending on where you look, you find statistics on all sides. So people, while we have a lot more information, we have a lot more confusion as well, because we don't know whether the information is accurate or not. I mean, let's be honest. We have information that's true. We have information that's blatantly false and just made up. And then we also have information that's just wrong. They're perpetuating wrong, myths, lies, whatever, because the people who are putting it out do that on purpose, and then they repeat it not knowing that it's a lie. And so it's very confusing right now for so many people, because how do you know what's true unless you're the one researching it yourself?
I think you almost have to be omniscient to be sure. And I don't know if most of us are capable of that yet.
Well, I suppose the goal is to find sources that you trust and then keep listening to them and try to get that information. The problem is that our trust has been eroded. A lot of the sources that we have traditionally trusted, we don't trust anymore, because we know that they are a mouthpiece for the government or administration or for big corporation. And not that government and big corporation is necessarily evil, because it's not, right? It's of the people. Making money
is of the people.
Yeah, yes. And it's not that corporations are necessarily evil, because making money in and of itself isn't evil. And we all work for something that makes money. That's how we eat. That's how we survive. Everybody has to make money. However, when the goals are making money at the expense of everyone else, and you're going to do whatever you can, doing propaganda, doing whatever you need to make money, that's when things go down. And the same with the government. They just passed a law a couple years ago that it is legal to put propaganda on the American citizens. And that is scary. So basically, the United States made it legal for them to do propaganda against us. And so much of what we're hearing isn't real. So if you go to another country and you hear news, it's going to be different than what you hear here. Now, you got to be careful. Just because you're in another country does not mean that's real either, because they could be doing propaganda. And so it's just really important that you work hard to look for the places that you trust as far as facts go. Now, I don't think that, like, I'll listen to certain media outlets that I trust their facts, but I don't necessarily trust how they're putting the dots together.
Right.
You know, like, I know that they have, because they really try to be honest, but the way they connect the dots, I think, is completely in left field. So I won't go with their paradigms, but I'll go with their facts. And then I'll put my own paradigms and connect the dots myself. But that's something that I work hard to do. But, you know, the average everyday person, do they have the time to do that? I don't know. It's hard.
No, I think, you know, since I'm delving into some of these issues, I think it's almost impossible for a person who doesn't have some time. I mean, you and I are doing this professionally, so we have time to do some research. But even so, we run up against that problem that you mentioned.
Yeah, we run up against ourselves, and we're in the field.
But in terms of your opinion, don't you feel like the United States government and commercial media, or at least conventional commercial media, seem to be failing in respect of freedom of the press? I mean, how would Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite think of these kinds of changes?
Well, I can tell you what Walter Cronkite, you asked me that question. You said you were going to ask me this question. So I went and I looked and see, before he died, he started seeing all this stuff. And so he had some pretty strong opinions on what, even at the time that he was working, he was viewed as the most honest man in television journalism. The United States, the citizens of this country really, really respected him. And 90% of people got their news from television at the time. And he had some interesting quotes, and he was pretty disappointed in where he was seeing this country go with the media. And he saw that it was being very watered down. And one quote that he said that I thought was pretty interesting was, "We've always known you can gain circulation or viewers by cheapening the product, and now you're finding bad driving out the good." So basically, they knew they could grow an audience, and that's where business takes over. We can grow an audience by watering this down, making it more entertainment-oriented, and not spend the money on hard news, because the average person doesn't care anyways. And that's what is killing us.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, you know, I grew up my father was an attorney, he was in civil rights, and did a lot of pro bono, and he was very concerned about both things that were, you know, like Vietnam War or the problem in, of segregation. All these things were brought to my attention when I was very young. And when this stuff started to happen, particularly in the Bush administration, and particularly with the torture was the first thing, I went into shock myself.
Well, the torture, you know, they did that in other countries so that they could still follow the law. I mean, that's the sad part, is they figured out ways to be able to torture people legally and still follow the Constitution.
Well, they figured out ways of saying that, but I think you and I would both agree that we're dealing with sacred issues like related to the Eighth Amendment, but also just related to, you know, human conscience.
Well, the spirit.
Conventions,
oh, absolutely.
Treaties that we signed, all these things that show that it isn't neither constitutional nor legal.
And, well, to torture and abuse people and hold them in captivity for years without a trial where we can't prove one way or the other whether they're innocent or guilty. I mean, if we have innocent people that are being tortured and held without a trial, that's evil. It's evil.
Well, the problem is you can never know if a person's innocent, actually.
I agree.
Except through legal methods, right? And that's a certain... That's certainly
well, even
limited.
Legal methods isn't
always. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect system, but to torture people to find out if they're guilty, you see some of this enhanced interrogation techniques were used by communist Chinese during the Korean War, and they were meant to do one thing. They were meant to get people to confess to things that they didn't do. And
well, yeah, so that when makes, you confess. I just want it to stop. I did it. Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you're accusing me of. I don't even know what it is. I don't care. I did it. Leave me alone.
Right. Exactly. And so doesn't that make you suspicious as to why in such a gigantic issue as terrorism that they would take these people and torture them to get information, thereby kind of assuring they're going to get a lot of false confessions, which builds the case for terrorism being such a terrible thing.
Well, and that's where you get into conspiracy theories and why are they doing this and why aren't they smart enough to realize that their methods aren't working? And then you go back to, well, I think they are probably smart enough.
And they are working.
There's only two things.
Yeah.
They're either not smart enough to know that their methods don't work and they're idiots, which we don't think they are, or they are smart enough, they know their methods don't work, and they have another agenda. And that's the scary part. If I want to think more highly of them, I'm going to think that they're smart enough to know that those methods don't work, and they have another agenda. And then that agenda is what's scary.
Well, this kind of negative disruption has basically infiltrated all levels of our society. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in just a minute.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects, like book covers, logos, web design elements, with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. You wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com for artist illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
Here's one of those strange songs from decades past that will haunt us for decades to come. Here's Misty from singer Patricia Welch's Great Entertainment 46 song 3-CD set entitled Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia. This is the kind of disruption and confusion we all need for once in a while, maybe forever.
Kitten up a tree, and I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud. I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Walk my way, and a thousand violins begin to play. Or it might be the sound of your hello. That music I hear, I get misty the moment you're near. You can say that you're leading me on, but it's just what I want you to do. You notice how hopelessly I'm lost. That's why I'm following you. On my own, would I wander through this wonderland alone? Never knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove. I'm too misty and too much in love.
That was beautiful, but now back with Sarah Westall and the all-too-real world we need to contend with. Speaking of those in government who are determined to dismantle our right to privacy. Sarah, don't you think that there's a certain element here of disruptive technology, which is new, which is basically something like surveillance technology, which has been worked on in great to a great degree through the government? So aren't we involved with a kind of disruptive technology here? Because people no longer can feel secure in their privacy when they're speaking on a phone or writing an email or browsing on the internet or doing social media.
Well, I think it's a shame that we don't feel secure. The problem is that we don't know who the bad guys are, right? And who can really watch us and who's conducting the surveillance. We'd like to think that our government are all the good guys, but, and you know, that's why, you know, Thomas Jefferson and all of our founding fathers were so against this kind of behaviors, because the government has to be, the government needs to serve us and we not the other way around. And when you're getting mass surveillance like this, the tide is turning. Who's serving who and what's going on? And we're no longer leading the government. The government's taking, you know, leading us and taking charge of everything, and the power's in the government, not in the people. And that's where the problem lies. And yeah, are we less safe maybe if the government doesn't have surveillance everywhere? Maybe. But that's the price you pay for freedom, right? I mean, that's what we have to get down to. And the problem might not be right now. Maybe we say, okay, there is quite a bit of good people yet in government, and we're not going to be, if they have mass surveillance, we're going to be okay. But as soon as you get a mob of people who are in charge, who are bad guys, who infiltrate parts of the government, who have that power, now we're really in trouble. And that's why the laws are in place, to protect you against that situation. Because you don't know when the government can turn. It's happened through history over and over and over again. If it's happened in history over and over again, it can happen here. And that's what we're guarding ourselves against.
Well, the founding fathers, included the Second Amendment in the Constitution. And that amendment wasn't specifically developed for protecting individual citizens, but for having state militias to protect themselves from an overweening national government, from a King George type of thing that might happen to them again.
Well, exactly. And so, that's the whole point, is that it can happen again. It will happen again. It happens again. It's history. It keeps repeating itself.
We're going to go to a break now, and we'll be back on the second hour of Threshold Radio.